Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.
So it's Tuesday afternoon again, and that means it's Real People. And you're listening to me, Jerry Pives. And we've just been hearing that beautiful piece of music by Louis Armstrong. What a wonderful world. And despite all that's going on, I believe if we can stay focused on all that is wonderful, then we'll find the strength and the resilience to get through these very challenging times. And to help us on our way, we have a wonderful guest today, someone I'm really looking forward to meeting, and that is Gary Muller. Gary Muller, have I said your name right?
You have it dead right, and you'd be amazed at how often people misspell it. But no, you're fine.
Well, welcome to Real People, and welcome into the psychotherapist chair. Gary, do you want to tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and what you do and give them a thumbnail sketch in less than 5 minutes?
Well, I live in central Wellington. My home where I was born is, in fact, Putaruru, which during the 50s and 60s, when I grew up there, it was very much a rough timber town. And I moved to the big city, which was quite a shock. My moving to Wellington was to assist Accident Compensation with setting up its injury treatment and compensation and rehabilitation programs and safety programs, of course. And my role was to set up accident compensations, sport and recreation, prevention, treatment and rehabilitation programs. I've been in Wellington since the mid or late 1970s. And I won't leave simply because, in my opinion, it is mountain biking central. It is mountain biking heaven. I love cycling in Wellington. It's amazing as a place. And as long as I can ride a bike and run and do those things freely, I'm going to stay in Wellington. Having said that, though, Wellington certainly has its problems. I affectionately refer to it as woke central. But perhaps we might like to go into that a little bit later. My role in life is very much to help people to be their absolute best, with a focus on their physical health, because without one's physical health, there cannot be an enjoyment of life. There cannot be quality of life, which is all essential. Longevity is one thing. But being able to have an enjoyable, productive life free of disease, injury, and disability is critical. And, Jerry, I'd add that body and mind are inseparable. They are one and the same. And, in fact, I'm almost reluctant about talking about my body. My body is me, and they are inseparable. Healthy mind, healthy body. In addition, Jerry, I practice the timeless rules of body heal thyself and food is your medicine. That goes right back to Hippocratic times, and it is a rule that has stood the test. And I am deeply disturbed at the direction of allopathic medicine, modern medicine. I think it is, when it comes to diseases associated with aging, with stress, environmental pollutants, poor nutrition, the nutrient depletion of food these days, it is an abject failure. I will qualify that by saying that I am in praise of modern emergency medicine. If I was to break my leg, get run over by a bus, stabbed in the back, or suffer a rampant infection, this is the best time in the history of humanity to be alive. Thank God for emergency medicine. However, the same model that works so beautifully for emergency medicine is a complete and utter failure when it comes to these other conditions, the ones that are of the greatest concern to humanity today.
Oh, I mean, I couldn't agree more, Gary. And I think the last thing I'd want if I was in a car accident is someone telling me I needed to stay off gluten.
Oh, look, I've really enjoyed history throughout my life. And it has been, in many ways, first and foremost for my study. And I just think of, like, you know, the reading about the Crimean War and, you know, the way that injuries were suffered and then treated. Oh, God, it's just awful. You know, the lack of anaesthetic, for example, let alone understanding the basics of hygiene and so on. Even a slight injury was, for many, a death sentence. So thank God for modern medicine in that regard. Jerry, I'll just add as well that I have a beautiful family. I'm in a loving relationship, a multicultural relationship, and they are my rock, my foundation. And I think there are, when we're talking about health, we can't think selfishly about just me, okay? Human beings are tribal. We need to have others around us, supporting us, looking after us, caring for us, loving us. One of the worst things, and I'm sure, Jerry, you'd be able to elaborate on this better than me, is one of the worst things you can do is exile a person, is send them into the bush to be alone, to be excommunicated, or whatever you want to call it, okay? But to be exiled is a terrible thing to do to most human beings.
And family for you sounds like it's a real rock. Is that right?
Well, yes. All families come with their complications there, and there are times we say, oh my God, we need a break. But, you know, I just look at my childhood in the 1950s and that. Oh, I was so blessed to have my brothers and sisters and a loving mother and father. My father was a hard man, but and I did resent him. However, if he were alive today, I would give him a hug and I'd apologize for tormenting him. I was a terrible teenager. but weren't we all? And it's not until we become parents ourselves that we realize how difficult it is, but also how important it is, the role of parenting in raising healthy children. And we only want the best for them. We absolutely want the best for them. And my childhood, it was just amazing.
Gary, tell me how old you are and tell me how many members there are in your family. And yes, start with that.
Well, I'm 70. I'm 71 in a couple of months. And the clock's ticking down very quickly. It speeds up as you get older, I'm sure. To me, my childhood appeared to be timeless. Now I'm waking up every morning and I realize, oh my God, it's countdown time. And I think as well, I'm in the kind of job where every day and sometimes every hour, I'm reminded of how vulnerable, how fragile life is and how short life really is, and that we should not waste a single minute without being paranoid about it, of course. But I could retire, but then I wouldn't be able to afford the repairs on my bicycles or to go and explore the world. And I've devoted just about the last 40 years to raising a family. It's been that long. It's almost as if your children never leave. Bless them. But now it's time for me to visit the world and also to take that knowledge and experience that I've built up with now something like 53 years of full-time study and work in the health sector in a wide variety of roles, I might add, and to now package that up in the form of, I guess, what is called wisdom and deliver that. Jerry, I think one of the most remarkable qualities of being human is the ability to figure out the world around us, to unravel the great mysteries, and then to package them up and deliver them to the next generation in a comprehensible form. And when I turned 65, you know, it's retirement time, and it's sort of like a rocking chair. That's what my grandfather did, kind of. And I thought, well, okay, I've got all this knowledge and experience, which is what wisdom consists of course. Now, do I take it all to the grave with me? Or do I do what I think is my duty? And that is to package it up and deliver it for the benefit of other people coming after me. So I've become a prolific writer and also doing my best to be a fearless commentator on controversial issues. Jerry, when I was at secondary school, I was in the academic stream and we had something called debate. You know, we had debating classes and, you know, they were uncomfortable because we would be forced to take a point of view that we might have absolutely disagreed with. And we had put our feet in the shoes of that other camp and argue on their behalf, no matter how cringeworthy it was. It was an exercise, I guess. Is it called empathy? And that was one of the most valuable things. In other words, you know, this is ageless, the idea of debate, of putting oneself in somebody else's shoes or being respectful of opposing opinions and trying to understand where they're coming from. And it's kind of, you could say, politics, because politics is really the art of compromise, isn't it? And that's something I learned at school, is how to debate and how to respect the opinions of others, no matter how distasteful those opinions might have been.
And how much is that missing these days? I mean, you're talking about one of the most fundamental missing skills, abilities, intelligences that I can think of. And like you, I was blessed with a school debating society. And it was really hard. But my goodness, like you say, we learned to listen. We learned to formulate our own thoughts. And we also learned how to communicate those ideas to other people so that they could be, voted. You know, it was a competition. You had to win, right? So you had to get the most votes from the audience. When I did it, my ones, it was a debating society and they took votes at the end. And it was someone won and someone lost. And it was lots of fun, but it was also very challenging. You talk about such an important thing here, Gary.
Well, yes, and I learned a lot of lessons in my childhood. It was an amazing, a wonderful childhood, Jerry, but it was a timber town and it was rough as guts at times. There was a lot of violence, a lot of bullying. A young man had, and even at primary school, you had to put your dukes up and you had to fight. Okay. And I got involved in a lot of fights, sticking up for myself and sticking up for my brothers and sisters. I was the oldest son. And so it was very much my duty to look after my brothers and sisters. And it was a rough town. If you think bullying is bad today, well, there was no shortage of bullying when I grew up, and there was little or no support, by the way. We had to deal with it ourselves, very much so. And one of the things I learned is that if you stand up to your opponents, if you handle them the right way, they become your allies. They ultimately become your allies. Now, I had a few good examples of that. Now, first of all, my dad, he was a hard man. I think he was in the boxing ring by the time he was 6 or 7 years of age. All of the young boys back there in the 20s and 30s, they all learned how to box. I should add, they learned how to box according to the Queensbury rules. In other words, when a man is down, you don't kick them, which is a rule that doesn't apply nowadays. So, Jerry, I'd never get into a physical fight today. Because there's no rules. Whereas back in those days, things were very physical, but there were rules. I can actually remember my father out the back of our house. Our next door neighbour was the police constable, a real big bloke with scars all over his face and broken nose and all that, you know. And my dad and him stripping off, they had a dispute over something. I have no idea. And they stripped off to their white singlets, and there they were, and they were having a fight. And my mother yelling at them to, you know, stop it, stop it, and telling us, all us kids, to go inside, you know, while Dad and the police officer were having a good punch up, you know. And here's the thing, at the end, they grudgingly shook hands. Yeah. And that was how disputes were dealt with. Now, as a young bloke, I was at school. I was not a big boy. I'm only 62 kilograms today, the same weight that I've always been. And I can remember a couple of occasions. Like, I'll just tell you of one where this bully was picking on me and picking on me and picking on me. You know, just and I wasn't responding. Okay. And then it reached a point after, on the way home from school, he just pushed it too far and I went at him. And he's bigger than me. And we had a real fight, not a punching fight, but, you know, all of our fights were mostly wrestling, Jerry. They were wrestling fights. Anyway, somehow I won. And, you know, there was all these other kids around. And then he goes, "I'm going to get you, Mola. You wait and see, Mola. I'm coming for you. You know, this is not over." And then, guess what? About 3 months later, he was my best ally when it came to bullying. He turned around. And in some ways, I kind of think of like the Trump RFK alliance that has just been. RFK, I think, referred to the alliance or their teaming up as an alliance of rivals or a team of rivals. You know, you don't have to agree. You don't even have to like. But there is this idea that people with competing interests can get together and achieve mutual goals.
Trump actually introduced RFK at his rally saying, "We don't agree on everything." And it was very uncomfortable because of some of the challenges that RFK was throwing at me. He said, I didn't like debating with him because he asked very tough questions of me. And there you have it, don't you? You have this idea that it's okay. And look what's happening, you know, with that. I mean, you know, that's an incredible development in America for sure. But it's a world development too, I suspect. It's giving an example on so many levels of just because we have disagreements doesn't mean to say we can't get along. And it's one of the most powerful, symbolic, almost archetypal images of the two. And Trump said, you know, he said, "I've never had someone get such rapturous applause as you've just had as I brought you onto my platform. So it was a Trump rally, and we know how they are at Trump rallies. They're just, it's like an evangelical meeting. They're high as kites some of the time. And it's like, and they went wild when he introduced Robert F. Kennedy. And he came from a Democrat tradition and a Democratic background. And here were all these Trump supporters cheering the hell out of him. And it was a wonderful example of really what the world needs to do, wasn't it?
Yes, I think I recall that Trump did insult Kennedy a year or so ago. He did definitely fire some insults Kennedy's way. But there are issues that are bigger than the person, bigger than the man, and they have to put their personal grievances or grudges aside. And they're all in the same boat. They're all paddling together in the same direction. That's what they have to do.
Absolutely, Gary. And just in case you're wondering what it is that you've tuned into, this is Real People in the Psychotherapist Chair. I've got Gary Moller here, and he's talking about some very interesting subjects: being bullied, standing up for yourself, debating, talking about what it is that we need a little bit in this world, a bit of understanding of difference, and how we can still ally ourselves with people that don't necessarily agree 100%. Now, I'm sure the listeners will want to know, Gary, a little bit more about what you actually do now, because there's a thing about cycling to ask you, I'm sure, and there's also a thing to ask you about hair tissue analysis, which I'm actually very interested in. I happen to know that hair tissue analysis of Sir Isaac Newton, I was a bit of a history buff myself, revealed massive doses of mercury in the man's hair analysis. They found some of his hair and they did a hair analysis of it. And it led me to discover that he was doing all sorts of spiritual and alchemical explorations, experiments with mercury. And I think mercury has a very interesting role to play in the new future that is emerging for us. But I became aware of hair tissue analysis and why he went completely bonkers. Isaac Newton went completely mad. And I guess if you inhale a lot of mercury fumes, that's a very likely outcome. But that's my little tuppenny worth of hair tissue analysis. But do you want to share with the listeners a little bit about how at your age you are so fit and healthy? I'm looking at a really fit and healthy man, a young man, and I'm looking at a man who, I know has worked extraordinarily hard to understand health all your life. So tell us, finish that bit of the story about how, where you have ended up and what you've ended up doing. And then tell us a little bit about the role of all your outstanding physical achievements.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for the compliment. I feel very normal, but then normal, I mean, what is normal by your definition or my definition or what have you? But why don't we just slightly digress? You can pull me back again, but let's just talk about mercury, okay? I'll start by saying that the first thing that we all of us must acknowledge, particularly as health professionals, is that statistically there's around about a 70% chance that what you and I are advising today will later be proven to be fully or partially wrong. So the worst kind of health professional is the professorial blowhard whose reputation has been built on a particular paradigm and who is completely unwilling or unable to admit that they got it wrong.
That's an interesting statistic. Where'd you get that statistic from, Gary?
Well, it's from a health economist who, in I think 2011, wrote a book called Wrong. It's Friedman, and if you go to garymoller.com to the blog, I've just republished an article I wrote in 2011 called Cardiovascular Disease Reversed, Here is the Evidence. And it's what I wrote in 2011 about my the beginning of my journey from ill health back to good health. And in that, I refer to the book with the title called Wrong. And that certainly was an important book, and it reinforced what I pretty much already knew, and that is that advice such as eating more than one egg a week is likely to diminish your cardiovascular health, as an example. I came across a study not long ago that you can eat 4.7 eggs per day, and it will have no detrimental effect on cholesterol. But also even the belief, and I'm using the word belief, that cholesterol is bad for you is actually wrong. Cholesterol that oxidizes, cholesterol that can't be used by your cells, might be unhealthy, but cholesterol is essential for life. And we should not demonize something because by doing so, we get things terribly wrong and we make people terribly sick.
Well, unless you happen to develop some kind of a drug that is anti-cholesterol that you can make billions out of, right?
Yes, a drug which for general use should be banned, by the way, a class of drugs called statins. And they will, for example, accelerate dementia. Here's the ridiculous thing about this approach to medicine. If you're treating somebody to prevent heart attack, or say somebody's had a heart attack, well, part of the standard prescription is statins, cholesterol-lowering drugs, and to go on highly restrictive fat-free diets, which by default depletes people of the fat-soluble vitamins, vitamins A, D, E, and K. And you can look up the health benefits of those for your brain, for your eyesight, for your bones, ligaments, hair, skin, nails, for your heart, and so on. So if you deplete those, guess what? Along with depleting coenzyme Q10, which is diet-wise is found in healthy animal fats. Now, if you're treating somebody for heart attack, yeah, when they're on statins and other heart drugs, yes, they may be less likely to have another heart attack or to have a heart attack, but that might be because they're too tired to go and exert themselves anyway. So if they become a couch potato, yeah, then they're less likely to have a heart attack. But guess what they die from? They die from heart failure. But if they've been treated to prevent heart attack and they die of heart failure, then it is a treatment success, okay? It's the old saying, which I learned very early on, the treatment was a success, however the patient died, okay? It's about like the Vietnam War B-52 napalm bombing raid, where you have to destroy the village in order to save it. You know, there are all of these neat sort of pictures that you can conjure up in your mind of the absurdity of so much of the medicine that we're subjected to. Now, let's just go back to mercury, okay? Mercury. Jerry, since you're a psychotherapist, I worked in Cherry Farm Hospital, one of the last psychiatric institutions out in the middle of nowhere, so that if, you know, one of the inmates, and they're all inmates, by the way, if they did a runner in their pajamas, they would end up at the local village. It's absolutely the middle of nowhere, central Otago. And of course, they'd turn up there cold and hungry to be greeted by one of the psychiatric nurses who they live there. So it's sort of like, oh, Jerry, what are you doing? You're a long way from home. Let me take you back. Nobody ever escaped. But anyway, it was really interesting because everybody was on medication, including my boss and all the other staff, okay? And I spent, well, yes, it's a nice, safe, comfortable place for somebody struggling with their own mental health could work. But anyway, I noted that everybody was on lithium medication. Now, if you look at the periodic table of the elements, you look at the weight, you know, so it's, hey, Jerry, lighten up, mate. You know, things are getting a bit heavy here. So they were on lithium. In terms of atomic weight, hydrogen, helium, lithium. Lithium is the third lightest element of the universe. And if you look at carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, the elements of life, they are amongst the lightest elements of the universe. Then...
Hold on, did you mean that lithium was heavy or light?
It's light. It's very light. Yeah, so if somebody's a heavy dude, give them lithium. Yeah, that's my interpretation. And if you look at the elements that are the basics of life, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, okay, they are light. Calcium as well, okay? Magnesium, they're all light. So then you look at the elements that give death, okay? The depressing ones. Think of Heathcliff in Wuthering Heights, okay? He probably had lead poisoning from drinking the water off the lead flashing, okay? Think of how the decline of the Roman Empire, they used lead to seal the joints of the aquifers. They put lead ingots into sour wine to sweeten it. And think of mercury, the qualities. Let's think of lead, okay? It's heavy, it's got a low melting point, and by the way, it's an excellent conductor of heat and electricity. And when you think of people with lead poisoning, they're easily influenced, they're heavy, foreboding, and they have a very low melting point, okay? Think of iron. Iron is heavy, it's red and fiery in color in its oxidized form, and the Nordic gods saw it as Thor, okay, with his iron hammer and anvil. And when Thor has a problem, just look at the Marvel movies, he will get out his hammer and whack it on the head. Think of somebody with iron toxicity. They are the rednecks. Okay? They're actually red around the neck. And that's one of the things. If somebody's got a problem with iron metabolism, they will often have a redness around the neck and on the cheeks. Okay?
Wow, this brings a whole new dimension to the psychology of minerals. Yes.
Isn't it fascinating? Well, it is, because you can't separate the physical body from the mind. They are one and the same, and we are childs of the universe. So a redneck is somebody you don't want to mess with. Righto. Now, if you think of mercury... Mercury is a liquid at room temperature. It flows. It's unpredictable. But it is also heavy, okay? And if you think of somebody with mercury poisoning, think of the Mad Hatter in Alice in Wonderland, because hatters used mercury to stiffen felt, and they would go crazy. Somebody with mercury poisoning will go crazy. They are unpredictable.
I never knew that was where the expression Mad Hatter came from, because they were using felt that was reinforced with mercury. Wow.
Mad as a hatter. Yeah, so we can go through the elements of the universe and we can look at how each or groups of elements affect behavior. Affect mental health. It's absolutely fascinating to see. And because, Jerry, we are just a collection of the elements of the universe. And in the end, you can even take us right down that ultimately we are light. Okay, we're just little packages of energy. And there's another principle when it comes to, and this is where the hair tissue analysis comes in. Every element in the universe, or every force in the universe, is governed by Newtonian laws. Okay, for every force, there must be an equal and opposite. If there isn't, then there will be dissonance, chaos, and so on. And if there are no forces, you have entropy, which is the worst thing to have. So think of this, yin-yang, black-white, hot-cold, male-female, positive-negative, liberal-conservative.
Good and bad.
Good, bad, you know, God, devil. Everything is oppositional, or it's a Goldilocks zone. Not too much, not too little, just right. And or think of a pendulum that swings beautifully within a prescribed range. You don't want that pendulum swinging too far one way or the other. Otherwise, you end up with chaos. Think of politics. A true democracy is where it is fairly a 1% victory. Okay. In other words, when it is a 1% victory, the winning party must listen to those who it defeated. Okay. In other words, you have balance. And if you have a victory where, say, it's 10% or 20% or greater, then you have a dictatorship, whether it is a left or a right swing of the pendulum. And you get unhappiness, great unhappiness, when you have that kind of imbalance. Think of a male-female relationship. If you have a strong male and a weak female, you have you have domestic abuse. By the way, if you have a weak male and a strong female, then guess who's wearing the pants in the relationship? If you have two weak individuals, then, well, what are we doing tonight, darling? I don't know. You decide. No, I don't know. You go. You know, nothing happens. Or if you have two very strong, excessive forces, male and female, then you have the War of the Roses, where they bang heads together and neither side gives up, and they end up basically destroying each other. The War of the Roses. And, you know, think of that Michael Douglas movie some time ago. Great movie to watch because it's a great example of what I'm describing. So if you want to destroy a healthy society, you introduce imbalances and confusions. For example, what is a woman? Okay, that's a classic. If you think about it, because what gives strength in society, it fundamentally is a strong balance between a man and a woman. Okay, where their respective forces come together to create the most beautiful harmony. Okay, and isn't that what we all seek?
You are a master of digression, Gary. I've got to take my hat off to you. You are taking us down so many interesting fields. You have me hooked on every topic of conversation. I could talk for hours on each of these. That you have such a fount of knowledge. And just to repeat, Gary, if people want to find out more about you, your writing, your commentary, and indeed your work based on a lifetime on health, they can find you at garymoller.com. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Or you can just use your search engine and just type Gary Moller and whatever subject you might be interested in, like Gary Moller inflammation. Hey, try Gary Moller COVID. That's a good one. And Gary Moller mRNA, Gary Moller chronic fatigue syndrome, Gary Moller glandular fever, Gary Moller arthritis, Gary Moller osteoporosis, Gary Moller vitamin D. Just do that and you will find them. Google does, I think, put me on the bottom pages because they don't look like my politics. But if you use my name, Gary Moller, and then the health topic, you will see that I've written thousands of articles over the years. And Jerry, I'll just say one thing, okay? I'm in my 70s. I'm physically doing better than I'd... Well, look, I went for a mountain bike ride yesterday. To my delight, I set a couple of career personal bests over trails that I've been riding since they invented mountain biking, actually. I don't know how long. It goes back to the 1980s, late 1980s. I'm in almost disbelief. But here's what I'm even more delighted about is that my fluency of writing, my ability to access what's in my brain has improved. In my 40s and early 50s, I suffered extreme writer's block. I just couldn't get stuff out of my head. It would just stick there. And I'd be, you know, it was a cold and wet night, and then it was sort of like, ugh. Okay. One of the my key performance indicators is not just how fast I can run or how fast I can ride a bicycle or whatever. It is how easily I can sit down and write something. And that's been really, really fabulous because 70s, you know, it's associated with decline, noticeable decline. There would be barely, it's very rare for me, for example, Jerry, to come across anybody over the age of 60 who is not on some kind of medication or got an arthritic joint or, you know, got the early signs of cardiovascular disease. It's just widespread. So I feel blessed, but I'll take the credit. It's because I have, especially over the last 20 years, invested in my health. And I can also say that, like, for my partner, Alofa, who is an older Samoan, I'm being very careful about how I say this, but she's the same weight that she was when she was at her fittest. She is an adventurous person like myself. I actually think she'll be the fittest Pacifica woman you'll find anywhere of her age. There is no disease whatsoever, no medication, no arthritis, no diabetes, no obesity, none of that at all. So I'll just add this. When people say, oh, but it's genetic, okay? It's not genetic. Your genes only contribute to about 10% of ill health. The rest is lifestyle, exposure to toxins, nutrient poor food, blah, blah, blah. And of course, not being in loving, supportive relationships. Is that what you're hinting, Jerry?
That is exactly what I'm hinting at, yes. The role of the mind in our health is obviously a major interest to me. But I absolutely take my hat off to you, Gary. You are a person who knows of what he speaks. You walk the talk, or you ride the bike of your health, and you're actually describing, and I just want to reiterate this, you're actually describing how you have become healthier and stronger and more alert in your 70s than you were in your 50s. Have I got that accurately?
Yes, you have. Jerry, I'll just add this before I overlook it. One little bit of important advice when it comes to a lifestyle or aging, you know, type disease, if you go to consult a health professional, if that person is obviously less healthy than you, then I recommend that you turn around and get out of that office really quick. However, if you've been run over by a bus or you've got an out-of-control infection, then I couldn't care less how unhealthy that medical person is, so long as they're the best for the job, okay, when it comes to emergency medicine. So again, I always qualify that. We must not just blanket bag all of modern medicine.
We don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, right?
Gosh, and we're doing that all the time nowadays. Jerry, that comes back to the concept of debate, the ability to put oneself in somebody else's shoes. It's so easy that if we don't agree with somebody, we throw them out the door, or we throw them under the bus, probably.
I've never met yet anyone with whom I cannot find common ground. Maybe that's because of the nature of my work. The nature of my work is always about relationship, about safety, about trust. And so these things require common ground, even though we are different, you know. But can I jump in here? Before you interrupt me, let me interrupt your interruption of me just for one second. I want to ask you, you started off telling a story about you working in one of the last remaining mental hospitals. And I don't believe you finished that because I was interested in what you had to say.
Well, first of all, yes, everybody was medicated. And I spent a good deal of my time trying to figure out who was crazier.
You mean the staff or the inmates? Yes.
I know. Well, it was. I think it was one of the ways that I managed to keep my own sanity. But here's the other thing: these crazy people, and some, I mean, were like probably serial murderers and that. You know, I mean, there were some pretty heavy dudes in that place. Okay, but in the end. They were still human beings. We still had common interests. We things in common. Many of them were actually very pleasant people. Some of them were absolutely brilliant. Well, hey, there could have been Isaac Newton there for all you know. And who knows? He might have just had mercury poisoning. And I'll just add with that, I'd say everybody in those institutions were suffering from malnutrition. There's no way they could have got better on the crappy food they were being fed and also the massive amounts of medication that they were being fed every day. And by the way, I'll just add, if they didn't take their medication, if they started getting stroppy, then they'd be given a dose of ECT, electroconvulsive therapy. And I'm a witness to that. I've sat in on sessions where patients or inmates were given doses of ECT simply because they weren't being cooperative. Okay. And by the way, I did write to the Minister of Health. I also wrote to the Royal Commission of Inquiry into Lake Alice. And they're the they are among the only ministerial inquiries that I've made or letters to ministers where I haven't had an acknowledgement of the correspondence. They didn't want to know, okay? They didn't want to know that this kind of practice was widespread in all of the psychiatric institutions throughout New Zealand.
Well, I want to just shout out to Rodney Hyde as well, one of my co-hosts, who's been running a series of interviews around this very subject. And he's been interviewing some really well-informed people. So if you're listening and you're interested in the subject of psychiatric care or what's the opposite of care? Abuse, I suppose, might be the word to use. If you're interested in psychiatric care or psychiatric abuse, then just search on the RCR app and find the Rodney Hyde interviews with many interesting people on this subject. And it's such an important subject. Again, we do have to be careful not to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And on our Psychobabble, monthly Psychobabble program that I run here instead of Real People once a month, we're talking about some of these subjects as well. And we're trying to find our way through because we have a psychiatrist, a psychologist, and yours truly on a little panel. And keep your eye out for that if you're listening. We discuss a whole range of subjects. And one of the things we're trying to do is exactly what you're describing, Gary, which is to debate, to have both sides. And, you know, you can't have both sides of abuse because abuse is something very bad and it needs to be wiped out. But you can also have a recognition. I mean, some of the most wonderful people I've met, for example, have been psychiatric nurses. They're really unsung heroes in the history of mental health and mental illness. And these people are creating really good relationships a lot of the time with people that are really in a lot of trouble. So I want to shout out to those psychiatric nurses who are doing incredible jobs handling people whose behavior has become intolerable for the families around them. And they're dealing with very extreme behaviors. And some of the psychiatric doctors who, not all of them are medicating like mad, many eschew pharmaceutical remedies. Many are doing everything they can, certainly long-term pharmaceutical remedies. And they're trying to work with short-term protocols. They're trying to bring people back into a state of what we now know as nervous system regulation. And some of these people would be hurting themselves or the people around them, but for the dedicated service of our psychiatric care. So it's very important that we don't alienate people who probably got into these jobs because they care deeply about helping other people. And I just want to say that because it's very easy to knock all psychiatrists and the whole psychiatric profession. And I have to confess, I have done that myself in the past. But getting alongside Dr. René de Monchy, who's on our Psychobabble panel, has caused me to rethink some of my own attitudes. And I find myself being much more, respectful of the motivation and the determination of so many health professionals to help people, even if the way they do that is actually the wrong way. That's not coming from a bad place. They're trying their best.
Well, Jerry, let me also add that my boss was just the most wonderful person for the job. He had his own mental health issues, as did many of the staff who found living and working in Sherry Farm the right place for them. And I think he was just wonderful with the patients or inmates, and they were inmates. And I think it's because he had his own suffering. He had his own ups and downs. And so he was able to put himself in their shoes. There were some terrible things that went on, but I have an enormous amount of affection for the people who worked there, who cared for these people, these troubled people. And yep, they got it wrong at times, but I'm absolutely in agreement with you, Jerry. I'd like to add as well that in my role nowadays, probably the most stressed occupation and under-resourced occupation are psychiatric workers. People who are out there assisting people with mental health issues, they themselves are under enormous stress themselves. They're totally under-resourced. There's nowhere near enough. And mental health issues are exploding in this country. And so I'm putting a big shout out of support for our mental health workers.
100% there, Gary. And also, I want to add something to what you're saying, because this is such an important area. Any family that has had one of their members go into, you know, really deep depressive states or really outrageous manic states, or their behavior has become really difficult, will understand just how exhausting it can be to be around someone who's at the edge of the extreme of their tolerance level for working out how to live life in a way that works for them. And when you work in an environment where you're basically walking through a sea of distress, and of course with a history of not really dealing, especially in New Zealand, I believe, not really dealing with the emotional causes of so much mental health problems. It's like we're like a bucket. And in my book, I write about the trauma bucket. And it's like very often when people are breaking down, when they've lost the control of their mood, their energy, their behavior, when that breaks down, very often it's like the last straw that broke the camel's back. And instead of exploring what the overload of trauma is and helping people kind of, as it were, unpack that, of which, by the way, exercise is one of the most powerful ways to do that from the nervous system point of view. If we medicate rather than understand and unpack and decompress the pressures and tensions that individuals have gone through, sometimes for many generations, and you don't need genes to pass down generational trauma. It's just passed down in the way that parents behave with children or don't behave. And so the mirror neurons of our neural system now, we know, convey masses of information. And if instead of unpacking all of this, which is understandable and easy to do, instead of that, we cover up with medications, we cover up the symptoms, we try and deal with those things, then what we do is we encourage the buildup in the trauma bucket. So we're actually encouraging mental breakdown in the way that medication is at the forefront of the way that this is being dealt with. And I think that I want to say that being around people who are constantly in that breakdown extreme situation is so hard, because the nervous system of every psychiatric nurse and psychiatrist and helper in the hospital is actually picking up, without us being aware of it, what the undealt with distress that the inmates or whatever they're being called are carrying. They're dealing with it all the time. And so and that's why the suicide rate for example, psychiatrists is five times the suicide rate of other doctors. And I think at least twice the national rate or something. I can't remember the exact figures, but it's five times more than it's twice as high as medical doctors and five times as high as the general population. So that explains the level of stress they're under. So I think, you know, we need to cut these people some slack, don't you?
Well, exactly. And some years ago, I wrote an article titled Stress Among Caregivers and asking the question, who cares for the caregiver? When I was studying rehabilitation, this came up again and again and again. Those rare, precious resources, under-resources that are channeled into people needing care, are directed at that person. And they neglect the fact that there are people around them, usually a wife or a daughter, who is looking after that person who is chronically unwell, whether it's mental or physical. And what repeated studies show is that there are high levels of exhaustion, mental exhaustion, amongst the caregivers. There's often comorbidities, they have their own health issues, and they are there are high rates of substance abuse, like alcoholism, and when that person that is requiring care, let's say they sadly pass away, the caregiver may then plunge into their own state of ill health. As the pressure comes off them, it's almost like the pressure valve is released, and we will see them plunge into their own state of exhaustion, whether that's depression or the development of some other chronic disease. So what we must do always, and in fact, if we want to care for those that need caring, in some ways you can argue that we should be putting more, or if not most of the resources, into supporting the caregiver. Okay, but we don't do that. We completely forget about them.
I love it, Gary. I love what you're saying here. And you see, in my profession of psychotherapy, a great deal of emphasis is placed on our own burnout and the danger of burnout because, you know, we're dealing with inevitably what's caused people to struggle with day-to-day functioning. So we're dealing with the cause of that, which I believe can be covered by the term trauma, although it has many, many faces, trauma does. But because we're dealing with that and meeting people and empathizing and in many ways mirroring and understanding their particular dynamic and what they've been struggling with, we're also incredibly vulnerable to, as it were, taking on the illnesses, not the actual illnesses, but the energy, the reflection of them in our neural system. And, you know, we are obliged by our code of ethics to take enormous care of ourselves. And we're not allowed to work without having a supervisor, which we, you know, if you're in private practice, we have to pay for. We have to pay for a supervisor who basically, if they're monitoring anything, they're monitoring our state of burnout and challenging us to get out more, to relax more, to have hobbies, to have time away from the work. Because if you're a workaholic in the field of illness and imbalance, you are going to kill yourself if you become obsessed with the work and you don't take the breaks. And I wonder if you have anything you want to say about that, Gary, because I'm pretty sure you're an exponent of the taking time out approach as well.
Jerry, anybody works in health, it's an exhausting profession to get into. And if you look at, you mentioned certain health professions, I'd say just about the lot, retirement doesn't treat them well. They tend not to live very long after retirement. As soon as the pressure comes off, it's like, boomf. What drove them? What got them out of bed? You know, you're talking almost like the workaholic. If that is removed, then the will to live may be less. And other things, very often after the pressure comes off, the disease manifests.
Well, this is captured in school teachers as well, because it's well known amongst education that end of term, end of the year, a lot of teachers just allow 2 weeks to be sick because it's at the end of the school term that their body suddenly goes, oh, and the body can detox. It starts to throw off what it's been carrying because of the pressure. So this is a well-known concept, which is, you described it rather beautifully, actually.
You're in a plane crash, okay? And you awake and you regain consciousness and you see around you burning and people screaming for help and so on. You know, the adrenaline bursts through your veins and you bravely start dragging people out of the wreckage and so on and so on. And then finally, the first responders arrive and they say, "Thank you, sir, you may stand aside. Okay, we've got it from here." And that's when you notice your wounds, your injuries, you collapse, okay? And it's after.
Because there's no adrenaline covering the symptoms, right?
Yeah, it's like living. Well, I do refer very often that we're living the life of a Middle Eastern donkey, okay? And you never get give a Middle Eastern donkey a day off, okay? Because if it lies down, it's never going to get up again. And so you've got to keep whipping it, you know, whip it, whip it, whip it. You know, more caffeine, more this, more that. You know, more stress, more this. You know, and you just keep going and going and going, okay? Like that poor little donkey. And I'm not, Jerry, you don't look like a Middle Eastern donkey, you know, get me right. You know, I mean, you look incredibly healthy for a health professional, by the way. you get the idea. And I was thinking, for example, of caregivers, okay? So this dear old lady looking after her husband, the love of her life, dying from or declining with dementia. He dies, she's dead 2 weeks later. Okay, I'm thinking of a specific instance of that. And that's what happens. The stress organs, the adrenals collapse. They go, oh! Or, you know, hey, marathon running. It's a classic. I've run quite a few marathons, but I'll tell you what, don't hang around at the finish, okay? Don't be at the finish, righto? Because, you know, the runners, they stride across the finish and smile and throw their arms up in the air with great joy in that, and then they collapse. And, you know, and half of them are carted off to hospital and all this sort of stuff. You know, if it's been a real tough day, it can be like a war zone. And so I've made the mistake of hanging around at the finish and looking. You know, it's not a good idea. Yeah, so people collapse after. Jerry, I wanted to also just sort of elaborate on this point of how we deal with conflict and opposition and so on, and about understanding that everybody wants the same. Now, I've spent just about my entire adult life within multicultural, multiracial communities. My partner is Samoan. My children are Pacifica, you could say, but they're also European, okay? They're Kiwis, first and foremost. And the other thing that we've done is we've travelled to other countries. We have a goal of riding our bicycles around the main islands of all of the Pacific and hopefully Asian islands, and we've done a lot of this. And the beauty about riding a bicycle through a native village, for example, and I think it helps having a loafer with me, is that you're greeted by the people. The children come up to you. You're really one of the people. You realise that they're all the same, we're all the same, our needs are the same. We will sleep on their mud floor, we'll eat their food no matter how poor it is. And the main thing is that we show respect. We don't act hoity-toity or as if we're some kind of superior being. And this is the other thing which I've realised, is that even the old man who worked his life laboring, digging ditches, and so on, they, in their own way, have their own intelligence. Just because somebody can do sums or cite a poem or solve a puzzle doesn't mean, in my view, that they're any better than the person who labored and raised a beautiful family. And that's something I've really learned, to judge people by how much money they've got, by how flash their house is, that's wrong. It's very wrong. Or by the colour of their skin. In my opinion, what I've learned is that we all want the same. We want security. We want to be able to raise a healthy family. We want to be able to provide food, warmth, and so on. All of these basic needs, and no matter where we go in the world, so long as we acknowledge that, so long as we treat our hosts with respect, so long as we thank them for their food, so long as we eat their food, then we have friends for life. When we fail to acknowledge that, we end up with war. We end up with fighting and so on. And that's one of the big things that I've learned. Now, the other thing is what we do when people wrong us. I'll go right back. My father was a hard man, but he was a very good man. I can remember when I was probably, I might have been 13 or 14 around that time, and Dad was a shopkeeper, and he kicked a couple of boys out, or older boys, so sort of like 16. He kicked them out, I think because they were thinking of shoplifting. Right, eh? So they came back at night, they strangled a cat, not our cat, they strangled a cat and then hung it on his car, on the windscreen wiper. And anyway, the police tracked them down. They admitted to their horrible crime. And so they were going to end up in court, and possibly they could have ended up being sent to Borstal. In other words, a sort of a boys' home come detention centre, and labelled for life as criminals. Dad intervened, and he said to the local Bobby, who he's had the fist fights with, he said, give them to me, okay? And for the next several months, they had to turn up at our home every Sunday morning, and Dad would take them for a run in the bush, out in the Pinedale forests. And it fair killed them, I'll tell you. But they had to do it, because if they didn't, they were in boy prison, okay? Child prison. And here's the thing, okay? They could have been criminalized, but instead, they were forced to undergo character building activities with a senior, a mentor. And they learned the importance of hard work and the rewards that came, because they became very fit and they became friends of the family. Okay. Instead of being our enemy, they became friends. So there is definitely a need for being tough, but at the same time to be accommodating. And I think that's something I've learned, and I try to apply it. I quite relish revenge, by the way, Jerry, but it's got to be an honourable form of revenge, if that's the right way of saying it, because what the ultimate goal is to turn your enemies into your allies. That is the ultimate victory, or the ultimate revenge as well. Does that make sense?
Oh, Gary, those are beautiful, wise words from a man who's thought, you know, and dealt with health. And really, when you deal with health, you're dealing with conflict. It's inner conflict. Often that inner conflict has come from familial conflict or world war conflict or national conflict. When you deal with healthcare, I do believe we're dealing with conflict, actually, the history of conflict. And these are beautiful, wise words, and they caused me to think, what a lovely way to end this interview. We've run out of time, Gary. Can you believe that? I barely believe you've walked in through the door. You've barely sat down in my chair, and I feel like we've scratched the surface of so many really beautiful subjects. But, I mean, it's just been beautiful to talk with you and to hear your experience and your knowledge, and somehow ending this interview where you started very close at the beginning. You started with the story of your dad having a punch up with the local Bobby, and then you end the interview with us talking about your dad going to the same said Bobby and saying, "No, let me help out here," and helping these two young lads have a different future, not to be labelled, taking them on some exhausting runs by the sound of it. Gary, there is so much more I would love to learn about you and hear from you. And I do want to remind the listeners, if they want to find out more about you, to go to garymoller.com, or, as he said, type in Gary Moller and practically any condition you can think of, I think, and it'll come up. You've been a strong advocate for health. You've dedicated your whole life to finding out and understanding how to make people better and healthier. And you've spoken out honestly and bravely during these times when free speech has been under attack. You're a very generous man. You've given a lot to Kiwis, and I think to the wider world, actually. So thank you, Gary, for your life, for your hard determination to find out about stuff in relation to health. And thank you more than anything else for this interview. I think you're going to come back and say something.
Jerry, can I just finish by acknowledging the support that I've had from my brothers and sisters, my five brothers and sisters. They really are my rocks. But most importantly, to my late mother and father for their amazing influence that they've had on me. I can never, I don't know how to thank them. It's just been amazing, and I'm proudly continuing the traditions that they've instilled in me. I just want to acknowledge that.
And in all of this conversation, Gary, I've forgotten to ask you the whole reason for this show, which is, number one, what gets you out of bed in the morning? And number two, how do you deal with stress and trauma? Answer me those.
Well, I am on a mission. As I said, I've got this knowledge and experience, which I don't want to take to my grave. I want to package it up and pass it on for the benefit of future generations. For what benefit it is, that's up for people to judge. I handle stress in various ways. First of all, there is nutritional support because we must fuel organs such as our adrenal glands. We must support them, nurture them, just like a good farmer will nourish and nurture their animals or their crop. And I commune with Mother Nature. So one of the things I love about Wellington is that I'm just minutes away from being in the regenerating forest. I can be up on a mountain. One thing I'll just say, I used to do, especially when I was working for ACC, a wonderful job, but stressful. And what I would do in the evening is I'd run up to the radar station, a long run, the highest point in Wellington, and I'd look down and I could see the lights of all of the cars winding their way out of Wellington into the Hutt Valley and so on. And I'd look down on it and I would think of them like ants. And I would think about just how insignificant we are as human beings, but also just the beauty of this planet, Mother Earth. And every day I'll get out and in some way I'll commune with Mother Nature. Mountain biking, it's fantastic for me because I get out into the bush and I can hear the birds twittering away and so on. It's just being one with nature. I think we should all do that. I do not encourage people to stay indoors, to work out in gyms. I encourage them to go outside and breathe fresh air, get sunshine, get the wind in their hair, and so on. That's so important.
Top tips from Gary Muller. Gary Muller, thank you so much.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057, that's 2057, or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so connect with us today.